You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 11th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and also just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's show, in the world of newspapers, a row deepens over the publishing of secrets. George Brock and Daniela Peled will be here to explain more. Then,
the Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons.
The chemical weapons inspectors rake in a Nobel, but what happened to Malala? Also coming up, theatre critic Matt Wolfe is here to review the highs and lows of the current musical theatre scene.
In the old days, musical theatre songs were pop songs, but in recent years that's been pretty rare. Elton John with Billy Elliot is the exception, but generally the two worlds are entirely divergent.
We also head down to the Monocle Cafe to meet Stuart Langley of the Disappearing Dining Club. There'll also be music, and we'll look ahead to the rest of the day on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Steve Bloomfield, right now. So, rather a lot to fit in over the next 60 minutes here on Aperitivo. But before we get started, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
The head of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the Director General Ahmed Uzunku, said today he hoped the Nobel Peace Prize to the organization would encourage further peace efforts in Syria and the ban and elimination of chemical weapons by the international community.
The decision by the Nobel Committee to bestow this year's Peace Prize on the OPCW is a great honor for our organization. We are a small organization which, for over 16 years and away from the glare of international publicity, has shouldered an onerous but noble task to act as the guardian of the global ban on chemical weapons that took effect in 1997.
Judges at the International Criminal Court ruled today that Libya was free to try Abdullah al-Sanusi, the former Libyan spy chief, who was a pivotal figure under long-serving ruler Muammar Gaddafi. Libya has promised to give Sanusi a fair trial on charges that were similar to the ICC's, so there was no need to transfer him to the court's custody. President Barack Obama and Republican leaders appear ready to end a political crisis that shut down much of the US government and pushed the country dangerously close to default. One senior Republican said an agreement could come today, though hurdles remain. Major US stock indexes initially posted their strongest rally in more than 9 months after signs of progress in negotiations to raise the US debt limit, at least temporarily. Alec Young is from S&P Capital IQ.
Markets are rallying very strongly just on the fact that there seems to be a way to address the debt ceiling and at least nudge the can down the road, if not kick the can down the road, because it's only 6 weeks. But I think the debt ceiling impasse was really what had Wall Street most worried. Potential default, downgrade, you know, those scenarios appear to have been taken off the table. Of course, the government remains shut down. So, you know, there's still work to do in terms of negotiating.
Four Americans who secretly met with the former NSA contractor Edward Snowden in Moscow have told a Russian television channel that Snowden had no regrets. Former US Justice Department worker Jesselyn Radak said many more are now willing to follow Snowden's example.
The Snowden effect has been the opposite. We have more and more whistleblowers coming to the Government Accountability Project than we have had before. So I think if the US is trying to clamp down and send a message by making an example, courage is contagious, and I really think he has had a wonderful effect for the U.S. and for the world.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who also met with Snowden, said the former NSA contractor didn't regret that he revealed secret information and was willing to face the future.
But this is an extraordinary person. He's made his peace with what he did. He's convinced that what he did was right. He has no regrets. And he's willing to face whatever the future holds for him.
Snowden, who worked for the National Security Agency in Hawaii, fled to Hong Kong in June and then flew to Moscow, where he was given a year's political asylum. President Vladimir Putin's refusal to hand him over aggravated already tense relations with the United States. And finally, the British food store Greggs has refused to sell Eccles cakes during Eccles Cake Week in Eccles, near Manchester, where the cake was invented. This has left sweet treat fans with a very sour taste. Eccles cakes are patties filled with currants. Greggs, of course, says there's currently no demand for them. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
You don't have to see my face to hear the cringe, can you? Jonathan, a quick question for you. How many northern towns can you name that also have their own cake?
Oh, very good question, that is. That's... I have to think very quickly off my...
You have. You've got about 10 seconds.
Dundee, but that's in Scotland.
Dundee's not bad. Kendal.
Kendal, of course, mint cake, yes.
Bakewell.
Well done.
Bakewell tart. Okay, I'm better at this game than you.
You are.
Okay, we'll come back at the half hour. You'll have got a better list. Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Aperitivo. We're back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
London is New York is Tokyo. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You are listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is 18:06. It's 13:06 in New York. My guests today are George Brock, head of journalism at City University and author of Out of Print: Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. And also Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and a former foreign editor at the Jewish Chronicle. Daniela, George, welcome both of you.
Very nice to see you.
Let's start with the media, one of our favourite topics here at Monocle 24. Now, depending on your view of things, the government secret leaks of Edward Snowden and his ilk are either heroic acts of bravery or the work of American, indeed British, hating traitors. The same could be said for the media outlets working with him. The Daily Mail newspaper here in the UK on Thursday published a column all about The Guardian newspaper, the British Liberal Daily, which worked in publishing those leaked documents, describing it as the paper that helps Britain's enemies. The Guardian, in turn, has today published replies by editors of some of the world's leading dailies, giving their opinions and, surprise, surprise, their support for the newspaper. George, is this just a slightly sort of inside baseball debate amongst ourselves, or is it actually a wider significance here about the role of the media and its relationship with the security services?
No, I certainly don't think it's an inside baseball debate. There's an important big question here, and in a kind of slightly weird way, the Daily Mail has opened it up in the way that other people haven't. There are two bits to the Snowden revelations. One is the fact that all the stuff he put out put a really important question into the public domain, which is how much of this should the intelligence services anywhere be allowed to do? But there is another issue to it. The Mail haven't handled it well, they haven't written about it well, which is it possible to get information like this out, start this kind of debate, start this argument, without actually putting anybody at risk? And we don't know very much about what those risks are. Snowden went to China, he went to Hong Kong, then he went to Russia. Any prudent intelligence service has got to assume that the information he had is in the hands of those countries to do as they want to. It seems a prudent assumption. It's not a certain one. It's just a prudent one. The point being that the newspaper didn't do any of that.
Yeah. Now, there's an interesting thing here as well, isn't there, in that it's very often when these sorts of leaks happen, you have those whose information was leaked jumping up and down saying they will have blood on their hands. You know, for example, when the first WikiLeaks stuff came out, you had US generals saying, well, this will definitely lead to deaths of people who've been identified. And that didn't quite happen, Daniela, did it? Is there a danger that there's a little bit of crying wolf here?
I think it's more than a, a danger, it's an almost certainty. I mean, we're told that lives have been put in danger. And as the Daily Mail says, agents have had to be moved. Well, you know, agents are moved around a lot. That's kind of what they do. But I'd really like to see some example of how exactly these reports could have been published, stripped of any information that would endanger agents. As I understand it, the meat of the NSA revelations is to show just how enormous the surveillance operations were. Enormous, enormous amounts of data and these incredibly sophisticated programs to be able to process them. I mean, that is fairly vague information in itself. I think there's something else here as well, which is that journalists doing their job is holding up government agencies, amongst others, to scrutiny. Now, it's kind of embarrassing for the government agencies when it's revealed perhaps the extent to which the surveillance has reached, but also the lack of joined up thinking, the fact that the government scrutiny we promised doesn't always exist.
Well, I mean, this is one issue, isn't it, George? This issue of how do you actually, in a democracy, scrutinise what your security services are doing? Because, you know, we're a democracy, America's a democracy. We want to be able to know what's being done in our name. And yet, you know, these are, you know, here certainly it's known as the Secret Service. These are clandestine operations at times. There has to be a degree of secrecy, doesn't there, for them to be able to operate.
But in the modern world, you have to ask exactly which bits of what they do have to be clandestine. There was a very interesting intervention to the discussion the other day by Stella Remington, who used to be the head of MI5, now retired. And she said, look, I think MI5 are doing the right thing. She wasn't criticising what they'd done, but what she was criticising was their failure to explain why they were doing what they were doing. And she added that she didn't think much of the so-called supervision system in Parliament for this kind of thing. She said, you know, if nobody believes it's any good, then actually it's in the interest of the covert agencies to look at a better system, because what's the point of them being in a system where nobody trusts them to do the right thing?
Well, exactly. And George has picked up on a point there that's worth pursuing, in that if actually no one has any trust in that supervision, then that's a bad thing for the security agencies themselves, Daniela, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there's always going to be a tension between the secret security agencies and journalism and government. And that tension is a very, very important thing. Now, without that, there isn't trust in the security services. And the point is for them to actually produce data and produce information which can be used in the real world, in government, in shaping policy, in preventing terror attacks. Now, without that, it loses its purpose, really.
George, when we look at what was actually, I mean, to take the Edward Snowden case, what was actually leaked, I said there were two main things. There was the first was the fact that it seemed to be, oh my God, it's everywhere and they can read everything and there seems to be no oversight on this. And actually the people doing the oversight had no idea that they could do all this. But then there were some other stories, like, for example, the barely surprising news that when foreign governments had been in the UK during a G20, that the British spy services had, well, you know, spied on them, which is what we expect, I guess, actually spy. Yeah, and if agencies actually do.
If we get hold of information that governments have been up to that kind of thing, they can, you know, they've just got to take the embarrassment that's involved. That happens from time to time. But one other rather interesting thing has emerged. The government has said, it's actually said it in an affidavit, because there's a case in the courts about the detention of David Miranda connected to this. The man who I think is the Deputy National Security Advisor said that one of the things that Miranda was carrying was a document or a collection.
This is Glenn Greenwald's partner.
Sorry, Glenn Greenwald's partner.
He was travelling from Berlin back to Brazil. He was arrested, he was questioned and detained for 9 hours in London a few weeks ago.
He was detained in Heathrow a few weeks ago and then released. And this guy in the affidavit said he was carrying 58,000 highly sensitive British intelligence documents. Now, presumably these came from Snowden. The question I think people ought to be asking is, what exactly is an American contractor at the NSA doing with 58,000 British intelligence documents so sensitive that people's lives are at risk if they're revealed? I mean, I think we have to be entitled to ask questions like that, inconvenient as they may find it.
And that's where, Daniela, it comes down to this issue of how much different security agencies share with each other. So, for example, there was initially when a lot of these revelations came out, you had some in the US saying, oh, don't worry, that none of this is information is taken from Americans. which all the technology companies were a bit like, yeah, you do realise we have lots of, you know, customers outside of America. And as George says, if there are 58,000 very sensitive documents from Britain that can be accessed by an NSA contractor, it does make us wonder what else is being shared between the Brits, the Americans, the Israelis.
Of course, you know, and I don't think anyone is arguing, any of the journalists, I don't think we'd argue that the security agencies can't be free to do any information sharing or any surveillance operations at all. But the fact is that we're talking about oversight and we're talking about there being able to be a debate. And again, as I said, it's embarrassing when information comes out and it's clear that people, you know, the agencies have been either spying on each other or sharing information when we don't really see what the need is for that information to be shared. But I think it also, I mean, I think there is also another element to this story, at the risk of emphasising inside baseball. The fact that the Daily Mail's reason for attacking The Guardian is very much a score points of itself. Last week it was under attack for publishing an article about the leader of the opposition, Ed Miliband. I'm not the first to make that mistake.
No, but yes.
Ed Miliband's father,
there
Raoul.
Is this sort of also sort of intra-British sort of newspaper war. Georgia, I just want to ask you about, you know, from an editorial perspective, if you are dealing with a story which has national security implications, what sort of process would you be going through? Because it's not like you get a leak and go, oh, well, we'll print this straight away and boom, there it is.
No, of course it depends on what the contents are, but the kinds of questions which a sensible publication would ask itself are individuals listed here? Are they named? What are we going to do about that, if anything? Now, that was an argument inside the offices of The Guardian on the WikiLeaks stuff to start with. We know that. You might, if you think it's safe, in certain circumstances, publications will ask the government if they want to give them advice. That will depend again on how the information arrived, in what form it comes, what it is, but that has happened sometimes, so that at least the covert agencies have an opportunity to say, you may not see how sensitive paragraph 9 is, but actually that's a killer. And you can then make your judgment about whether or not you're going to publish that if you're in a position to do so.
But this strikes me that this only works if we have a system where everyone sort of trusts each other to a certain extent, that as a newspaper editor, you will trust the government agencies to be honest about what they feel is, you know, going to get them into what will be embarrassing and what will be dangerous.
Well, there's an element of trust and actually, in truth, if journalism really operates as it should, there's an element of mistrust too, because you never quite totally trust governments to do the right thing all the time.
No, I think that's reasonable.
And you are always kind of checking on new developments which produce the possibilities of something you might mistrust. We were talking about The Guardian and the Daily Mail just now, but the Guardian have collected these editors. There is a very, very conservative paper in Germany called the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. That really quite stuffy, cautious, sensible, extremely middle-of-the-road paper. And in their editorial, they just say this one, what I think is a really magisterial thing. The Snowden affair one day will be understood as a historic milestone at which democratic societies began to realise that the political cost of new technologies still needed to be negotiated. Now, that is a very good definition of why this is important.
And it has been interesting as well, looking at that whole issue of technology and who really understands it, trying to hear some of the British politicians in particular grapple with what this technology does, as in technology that, you know, for many of us is quite basic. For example, Daniela, there was this remarkable incident where the security services gentleman from GCHQ insisted on destroying a laptop in the Guardian's offices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe a buzzsaw was involved.
Yeah, despite the fact they said, you do realise that we have lots of, like, these files are on. You know, it reminded me of the part of in Zoolander. But who knew we'd be referencing Zoolander in a discussion about international affairs, where they destroy a computer by throwing it to the floor because they have no idea how computers work. It was that sort of element of foolishness, which
it's
makes
also,
this sort of thing
symbolic.
Quite difficult.
Yeah, it's symbolic as well. You know, they want to show how they demolish it physically. I think a lot of this is symbolic. You know, it reminds me of the tangentially, it reminds me of the issue we had in summer, this summer in England, with the so-called racist van, which was a van that was driving around London with a big sign saying,
"Go home.
Illegal immigrants, go home," and a sort of hotline number. And there's an enormous debate about it. I think I read today that one illegal immigrant was deported as a result of it. It was all about political capital. It was all about making these points. And I think a lot of this debate about national security goes along the similar lines.
Is there a danger, George, though, that, you know, that we can be a bit too liberal about this, and that, you know, there might be, you know, the end of the boy that cried wolf, eventually a wolf does come?
I said there are two sides to this, and the second bit, which is, did it actually put anybody at risk? We still don't really know that. It is possible we're going to discover that Snowden, and I repeat, Snowden, not, as far as we know, any newspaper so far, may have disclosed things at a time, in a way, which did put people we would like to see protected at risk. We don't know that didn't happen. That question is still open.
I think we have to be shown it, though, before we believe it.
Okay. Oh, sure. No, of course. I'm just saying we can't close it. It's not a definite.
We're going to leave it on that note, I think, with a little bit of agreement there at the end. We are going to be talking about the Nobel Peace Prize, who won it, who didn't win it, right after this.
Romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whisky, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, don't you got any problem getting custom in? And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu. Every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2013 is to be awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, for its extensive work for eliminating chemical weapons.
Yes, the Nobel Peace Prize has been announced, and it's not Malala Yousafzai. I'm still here with George Brock, head of journalism at City University, and Daniela Pellid, editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. I've got to say, Daniela, I quite like the fact that there's no messing about with this. There's no, like, and the winner is, drum roll please, or, you know, I'll tell you after the break.
He noticed that as well. There's no dramatic pause. He just gets straight in there.
Yeah, he needs to watch X Factor. He does. The OPCW. We know about this now because of the whole Syria issue. But do you think actually the fact that this organisation is now getting this award is obviously going to be far more focus on, frankly, a group that not many people know a great deal about, Daniela?
No, that's right. I mean, this group has been going for 15 years now. It's relatively small. I think there's 500 employees, which is not very many for the amount of work it needs to do. And it's been doing, you know, slowly and surely dismantling stockpiles left from the former Soviet Union and so on and so forth. Now, it's got its work cut out, though, in Syria, which has got 1,000 tons of chemical weapons and nerve agents spread across the country.
Some in actual war zones, active war zones.
Well, yeah, this is it. I mean, they've never had to do this kind of operation before.
It's usually a sort of a country, so, you know, either a new broom comes in and says, oh yeah, hi, we have some chemical weapons.
Yeah.
Would you like to come in and get rid of them?
Yeah, like in Libya, where Gaddafi said, you know, held his hands up and said, okay, enough of this now. But in Syria, it's very different. There's no reason to think that they won't be targets. And what's more, they've got 9 months to complete their work, which seems really implausible. It seems the sort of work that would take, especially under fire, that would take years and years.
Well, if it is successful and they do all this in 9 months' time, maybe they can win the prize all over again in a year's time. George, is the Nobel Peace Prize worth it? Does it have relevance?
Oh, I think it has relevance and it has resonance. And I can see the value to an organisation which has worked, you know, in some obscurity, isn't terribly well known. The American Secretary of State keeps mispronouncing its name or misunderstanding its name and that kind of thing. So I wouldn't take away anything from the excellence that they've done. But I think one of the values of a prize like the Nobel Peace Prize is that it to me, is an inspiring life. And you can't get that narrative power if you give the prize to an organization.
Mm.
The most inspiring resonance is going to be about a hero or a heroine, I think. You can't really alter that fact.
Sure, but actually, is there something a bit better about instead of making someone a hero or heroine and putting them on a pedestal, saying, actually, this is an organisation where 500 people have worked, many more have worked over the last 16 years. They are an organisation that makes the world a better place. It's less sexy.
I don't think there's any doubt they make the world a better place. I mean, they've destroyed 80% of the world's stocks of chemical weapons. That's a tremendous, fantastic achievement by any measure. But what you're doing, if you make that choice, is you're sacrificing some impact. Because the one thing that a prize has, a prize as big as the Nobel Prize, is it's an educator. It teaches people for free without having to put people in class and tell them about heroism and heroics and sacrifice and doing good things. It just does it for you. And you're losing some impact.
But are we, Daniel, perhaps also living in an era where it's quite hard to work out who those heroes and heroines might be? I mean, we've been talking about a 16-year-old schoolgirl as if, you know, that was all that we had.
Look, it's all super symbolic, you know. But I mean, I agree. I have to say, I think that Malala Yousafzai and the other cat that would have been a better winner, not to downplay the work that the OPCW does, but her story is incredibly resonant. And not only that, the effect it would have, you know, on Pakistan as well. And I was talking to colleagues today in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and there's a Congolese doctor, gynecologist.
Dennis Mukwege.
Yeah, who was up for the Nobel Peace Prize. And they were heartbroken that he didn't get it. I think he would have been a fantastic candidate because the work he does is really underreported, underfunded. And it would have been such a cause of pride for the country. And I think that would have had a far wider effect.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. George Brock, head of journalism at City University and author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. It's a very long title there, George.
They love it for the search engines.
I bet they do. And Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and a Monocle 24 regular. Thank you both very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Aperitivo. We'll be talking to Stuart Langley of the Disappearing Dining Club very shortly. We're also going to talk theatre with Matt Wolfe. And I'm sure we'll grab a couple of people from upstairs, come down and tell us all about the Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. But first, here's Jonathan with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The head of the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, Director General Ahmed Uzurkum, said today he hoped the Nobel Peace Prize to the organisation would encourage further peace efforts in Syria and the ban and elimination of chemical weapons by the international community. Judges at the International Criminal Court ruled today that Libya was free to try Abdullah al-Sanusi, the former Libyan spy chief, who was a pivotal figure under long-serving ruler Muammar Gaddafi. Libya has promised to give Sanusi a fair trial. President Barack Obama and Republican leaders appear ready to end a political crisis that shut down much of the US government and pushed the country dangerously close to default. One senior Republican said an agreement could come today. And the former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who met with Edward Snowden, said the former NSA contractor in Moscow, this was, didn't regret that he revealed secret information and was willing to face the future. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Aperitivo Live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio. Time now to talk to Stuart Langley, owner of the Disappearing Dining Club. It's a one-table restaurant in London with room for just 10 people. So why not 11 or 12? Well, I don't have to ask him because Tom Edwards is here to do the questioning for me. Tom, over to you.
That's right, Steve. Thanks very much. Stuart, that's a good place to start. What is the perfect number to have for dinner? Is it definitely 10?
Well, in our first dining room, we've got a new restaurant now which seats a massive 30, so we've kind of tripled in size since that first table. But yeah, I think the perfect number is as many people as you can fit in and that you can look after and make sure everyone is happy.
And so tell me, when this all began, it was presumably talking about, you know, convivial dining, a social experience. As these things become more successful, they become bigger, they're more popular. Can you retain all of those sort of fundamental values? Has it become more difficult once you do triple the size, interestingly, in a multiple of 10? Maybe that's the secret. How do you stay true to the sort of the original concept? Is it easy or is it actually quite challenging?
Well, what we generally do is we take people into unusual spaces to have dinner and use food to force people that don't know each other to interact together. And so even on a very big scale, that is happening. You might have a long table that might have 100 people, but the process of people sharing and meeting people is happening lots and lots and lots of times down that one big, great big long table. So you have kind of two experiences then. You have the immediate experience of sharing the food, but then you also have the wider communal experience with everyone else in the room, and then after dinner people can kind of get up and talk to each other and there's an immediate thing to talk about.
Sounds very agreeable to me. Now, you mentioned there fairly lightly some interesting spaces, but that's only really half the story, isn't it? I mean, it's been from, well, salvage yards, churches, fashion stores, railway arches. What kind of challenge, I suppose, from the obvious logistical problems, what are the main kind of challenges when you're trying to sort of cater and entertain and keep people happy in a space that can be pretty unorthodox?
Yeah, well, there are three things that we need all of our spaces to provide. And from there, pretty much we can make any space work for a dinner party. So we need a certain amount of power so we can plug things in. We need a certain amount of water so we can keep things clean and tidy. And we need the right amount of toilets. And we've got...
Very important.
Very important. And we have a rule regarding toilets, which is we've got the mother rule, which is if the toilets aren't of a sufficient standard that you'd happily allow your mother to use them, then that venue we can't actually use.
Most pubs in North London, out.
Out, exactly. But funnily enough, lots of warehouses all over East London, in.
Intriguing. I like that. It's a good indicator, I think, of a quality establishment.
Absolutely.
Now, it's interesting, you're talking about food principally, but I gather as you reach for your rosé. Drinks, another thing that you're very passionate about, and a bit of your background, I guess, as well. It was in the sort of drinks industry or the drinks experience as much as the food. Obviously, they go together perfectly. Would you sort of describe yourself as a food person now, or is there always that sort of, is drink, as it were, in your blood?
When I started working in kitchens and then went from kitchens into bars and then from bars into more kind of higher end drinks led wine cocktails, and then kind of on the event side. So what I feel are my kind of fairly unique skill set is kind of a very general sense of how to make a place work so people have a really great time. We like to put food, drink, but also music and people and space and environment and all the things that make up a perfect dinner party. They are all as equally important to us. So if you're a foodie person, you should come along and have great food and really know that we care about food and we care about the things you care about. But the same should be the case if you're a drinks person, or you're really looking for something unusual in terms of space for you to be in, or you just want to have great music, or all of those things might be equally important, or none of them, but you just want to have a nice time and you don't really care how.
I think they're all pretty important to me.
Yeah, definitely.
I get that. I just wonder that you mentioned unusual food, unusual drink, unusual locations. Where does the inspiration from these things come from? Are they ideas that literally strike you from one day to another, or is it slightly more considered? Because some of the, I guess, more, people might say, slightly eccentric flourishes with which you've approached this. So now and again, you've had beach huts and smoke houses and all these kind of things. Where does that come from? Do you literally see these things and think, do you know what? This would be perfect. Or do you sort of go out on the hunt? How does it work?
It all comes from the available spaces. So I'm always looking to keep everything fresh and interesting for us and for all of our guests. I always need a new space to find and a new space to offer. And then the limitations or the opportunities that space provides then sets me thinking about what the right food solution and dinner party solution would be to that space. So we kind of menu to the venue. We match the kind of dinner parties we want to do to the spaces we have available.
And how do you find that the diners fit into that sort of equation? I like menu to the venue. That's good. But how do the diners fit in? Is it often the case that people, as soon as they enter these sort of slightly more eclectic venues, kind of connect straight away with the menu and with what you're trying to do? Or do you ever have people who, maybe it takes them a couple of courses or a couple of drinks perhaps to really sort of switch into it? Is it sometimes a bit of a balancing act? Do you sort of watch and think, oh, they're sort of on the brink of enjoying this? Or do they? Is it an immediate thing, like a switch is thrown and they really engage with it straight away?
I think drink certainly helps. and I think there's an element of, if you're coming to one of our dinner parties, then you're coming along because you want something that's more than just like going to a restaurant. So what that is, they may not exactly know what that is until they kind of feel more comfortable. So it's kind of like a part of the challenge. You know, it's good that we challenge people in terms of the spaces that we're going to be, that we take them to, because that's a part of the excitement of a dinner party. But then as soon as they sat down, they've had a drink, they've got some food in front of them, then all of a sudden they know what to do. So when you arrive, you might not know what to do, might not know where to be, who to speak to, how to interact. But then as soon as you're at the table, it's, you know, game on. You know exactly where you are.
It all makes sense.
Enjoy yourself.
Now, tell me, Stuart, a little bit about some of the other sort of directions this has gone in. Perhaps, I don't know whether it was a surprise to you, looking at sort of raising money, a bit of a philanthropic edge as well, if you liked what you're doing. Tell us a bit about what you're doing and why exactly you've decided to do that.
We've chosen to support Teenage Cancer Trust through all of our ticketed events and through Back in 5 Minutes, the restaurant, because we have an opportunity to build our own business how we want to. So it's kind of like, I feel very fortunate to be in a position where I've been able to start my own business, and therefore I can do with it what I wish. So if I'm going to try and create the perfect business, then I've got an opportunity to use our customer base to raise money for a cause that's kind of close to my heart and I think is important. And, you know, I just feel it's a great opportunity to do something. So why not do it?
What a fantastic idea. I just wonder, it's perhaps not a radical suggestion, but it's interesting, isn't it, that you say there you've got the sort of freedom, the flexibility to approach your business in maybe a slightly different way than perhaps a more conservative restaurateur might. Do people ever say to you, oh, this is a bit unorthodox, isn't it? What are you doing? How are you making this work? Are people generally full of sort of admiration? Do they sort of ask you how you've done it? Or do some people sometimes say to you, you must be mad?
I remember there were a number of people who kind of said that we must be mad when we kind of started it all off, and I described, with the vision we had at the time. But the unorthodoxy is a part of the reason why people come back to us to find out what we're doing next. We're always looking for something new to do. We like, myself and my business partner, the chef, we want to put ourselves in these unusual situations because we can create something unusual and different for our guests. And that we think is very, very special. And we think that's an opportunity. So we want to just continue to do that.
And I guess just as a final note then, people are often wondering, what are you doing next? What are you doing next?
Well, the next things we're doing is we launch in Manchester. We have 3 dinners in an amazing mill, which has been shut for about 120 years. And will be being opened up by some very nice people in Manchester just for us. And we're doing 3 dinners in there before the end of the year. And then we've got a large kind of New Year's Eve event that'll be, I think we'll be feeding 700 people for that.
Wow.
So that'll be
that's quite a lot more than 10.
That'll be a corker. and then, yeah, we've got a slaughterhouse supper on Halloween. And then...
Is that based on Slaughterhouse 5?
It's not. It's very different.
Okay. Well, I'm not coming there.
We'd like to do some international stuff. We've got lots of opportunities for next summer. And as soon as we can get start working on those, that'd be great fun.
Exciting times.
Tom and Stuart, thank you both very much. That was Stuart Langley, owner of the Disappearing Dining Club, with a very thirsty and now very hungry Tom Edwards.
Absolutely.
Well, you've got wine. You've both got wine in here.
I want more wine.
Can I just point out that our producer, Danny Giacopelli, has been refusing to give me wine while you've been having wine. Anyway, there we are. We are going to be talking theatre with wine or perhaps not with Matt Wolfe right after this.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
At 1844 here in London, 1344 in New York. As promised, time to talk theatre. Matt Wolfe is the London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune. He spent 2 decades as the London arts and theatre critic for the AP before that. Today with him, we're reviewing The Light Princess and The Commitments. Matt loves one and hates the other. Let's find out where they stack up. So Matt, the nights are drawing in. The weather has turned. It can mean only one thing here in London. It's
going to bed there earlier. It's early to bed.
The musical season is upon us. London has a sort of quite a fine tradition of some very good musicals, and let's face it, some very commercial musicals.
Yeah,
that's kind, isn't it?
Yeah.
And 2 big ones have just kicked off that you've seen this week. One which was rather good, and one which was perhaps not quite so. Is
yeah,
that fair?
That's absolutely fair. And they're both sort of Marmite musicals in that people love or hate them in equal measure with both shows. So I just say that as an advisory. People should take this with a pinch of salt, as they always
do. So they
do.
May well love the ones you hate and vice versa.
And hate the one I love.
Okay. So
that's how it is.
So the two we're talking about are The Light Princess, which is based on an original story by George MacDonald, but perhaps more importantly for this, the music and lyrics are by Tori Amos. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to talk about The Commitments, which, yep, frankly, everyone should know. Yep. Let's start with The Light Princess. You look at it and you think, wow, Tori Amos doing a musical. This could be either absolutely amazing or an absolute disaster. Which one is it?
I thought it was much more towards the absolutely amazing. Would I give it 5 stars? No. Would I give it 4 stars? Yes. What's interesting with musicals in general is one's always looking for the crossover between kind of the pop artist and the musical theater world. In the old days, musical theater songs were pop songs. But in recent years, that's been pretty rare. Elton John with Billy Elliot is the exception. But generally, the two worlds are entirely divergent. In this case, Tori Amos and her collaborator, Sam Adamson, have been working for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years on this. The show was postponed. Now it's finally up and running. What's lovely about her score, and I'm a great fan of hers, is that it's not a series of numbers. If you want big buttons on the songs, big sort of bravura moments out of, you know, Les Mis, you're not going to get that. It's a soundscape. It is an ambient environment.
Does it feel a bit more like a film soundtrack that's been scored by one person rather than...
That's actually a really smart way of putting it. It feels like a kind of ambient world that you might find in a movie and that generally on stage you don't have. But what's extraordinary here is that she's able within this kind of 2 hours and 45 minutes, actually, soundscape to have sort of motifs and ballads and anthemic numbers, but none of them sort of announces themselves. And I actually really like that because you have to look at the whole, not just the component parts. It's also an extraordinary feat of stagecraft because the story, as you can tell from the title, is about a young royal, the light princess of the title, who literally defies gravity in the course of the show. And the actress-singer who plays the part, Rosalie Craig, spends almost none of the time with her feet on the floor of the Littleton stage. Now, that might sound like nothing to you, but I'm sure that for her, it's pretty remarkable because she is airborne and aerial, and she has to sing and do somersaults and backflips, and it's quite extraordinary.
It sounds it. Now, as you say, it's on at the Littleton, which is part of the National Theatre.
Right.
Do you think that this will appeal not to your normal sort of West End crowd that they're trying to go for? Obviously, the people that would like Tori Amos, but more of a theatre-going crowd.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about the National Theatre, particularly under Sir Nicholas Heitner, who runs it now, who's about to leave in the next year or so, he has directed many musicals, including Miss Saigon and Carousel, but since his tenure running the National a decade or so ago, his musical choices have been really on the front foot. He started with Jerry Springer, the opera, which put the cat amongst the pigeons. And now he's finishing with this.
Well,
he didn't direct
it, but he had London Road.
That's right.
I mean, it's strange to say this was a musical about the murder of five women working as prostitutes, but that's what it was, and it worked astonishingly well.
Yeah, I mean, what he's interested in is the parameters of music plus theater. What do those equal? And it's not about just having a big power ballad at the end of the first act that everyone goes out going, wow, what a voice. It's like something out of, you know, Pop Idol. It's not that kind of thing. It's much more about the inherent fabric of the piece. This is, as I say, not a perfect piece. Some of it is a bit sort of dewy-eyed. Some of it you can't tell who it's aimed at. Is it young adolescent girls? Is it adults? Hard to say. But as a new piece of music theater, it's quite exciting.
Okay, let's turn our attention to The Commitments, which, as most people know, was a rather successful film in the early 90s, based on a Roddy Doyle novel.
Yeah.
And this strikes me as the sort of thing that's been chosen to be put on stage because, oh, everyone knows The Commitments and, oh, the songs are great. It'll be brilliant. Yeah. And with perhaps less thought about whether it all hangs together. Does it hang together?
Well, I love the film. I actually went on a junket for the film to Dublin to Jury's Hotel in 1991. I remember it as if it were yesterday.
Right.
You probably weren't born then. But what's wonderful about the film is for all of Alan Parker, who directed it, for all of Alan Parker's slickness, it's got great heart.
Mm.
What's shocking about this stage show, which Alan Parker had nothing to do with, is that it has virtually no heart. And more to the point, it has virtually no soul. And given that it's a show about a Dublin band who end up being, you know, the arbiters of soul music.
Yeah, they're doing Otis Redding, they're doing James Brown.
Yeah, I mean, all of that. Wait for the Midnight Hour, you know, Try a Little Tenderness. The songs are great, but the show seems really crass, really cheesy, and geared at kind of the hen night party on a Friday night who've already seen Dirty Dancing. And they're looking for another title they already know, where they can rock out, get pissed, and go home in an inebriated state.
But this will do well, though, won't it? Because, you know, I hope you're, from that tone, you say no, but I mean, I hope you're right if this is how it is. But these things tend to do quite well, don't they?
I'm not sure because the thing about Dirty Dancing is it has that hook of nobody puts baby in the corner. You know, there's a real sort of sexual frisson to it. In this, there's nothing except this group of young Dubliners who form together in an ad hoc way to do soul covers. It does have a star-making performance, as The Light Princess does, from Rosalie Craig. This has a star-making performance from a 29-year-old Irishman based in London called Killian Donnelly, who plays the lead singer Deco. And he belts out the numbers to beat the band, and how he does it 8 or 7 times a week, I don't know, but he is the major discovery of the show.
I'm just saying, great songs, no soul, terrible storyline. The reason why I think it's going to be a success, I have 4 words for you: we will rock you.
What more can one say? You're a prophet.
Let's leave it there. Matt Wolfe, theatre critic of the International Herald Tribune, for only a few more days.
I know, International New York Times as of next Tuesday.
Next time we
it's
see you.
It's the end of an era, beginning of a new era.
Indeed, the beginning of a new era. Matt Wolfe, thank you very much for joining us on Aperitivo. Let's not have a song, though. Well, we'll have a song, but not a musical song, not a music-ish song. You know what I mean. Let's have this. It's Steve Mason, formerly of the Beta Band, with A Lot of Love.
I keep walking in the desert, though there is another one, and she told me so. She told me so.
There we are. A Lot of Love by the brilliant Steve Mason. It is 18:54 here in London, which means if you want to count down, 1 hour and 6 minutes until Globalist Asia, and a bit longer, 3 hours and 6 minutes until Michael Daly. There you are. There are your time checks. I'm telling you that because I have the producers of both the Globalist Asia and the Michael Daly with me here. Hello, Barbara Feeney.
Hello, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello, Mark Cassippi.
Hello, Steve Bloomfield.
Remind me, who's doing which show?
I am doing the Monocle Daily.
Okay, wonderful. Right, we'll come to you in a moment then, Barbara.
Because it's me first.
That's why you look so pained on your face, Marcus. You're sort of, you look like you've got lots to do.
I am not pained, but the situation is that I was having a very deep discussion with this programme's presenter, Andrew Muller, on one of the topics, how we should handle the topics. And we literally discussed for about 10 minutes. It was almost a debate. Ooh. And then all of a sudden, I see Danny Ciaccapelli's face, who was slightly stressed-looking producer, was wondering where I am, because I'm meant to be in the studio.
The debate you were having with Andrew Muller was about what?
It was about a Nobel Peace Prize and who we're going to be talking about and how we're going to be covering that. And we actually decided to do everything we can about that. So we start. So we have Lars Bevanger, who's been doing a report on what's been going on today in Norway.
We love Lars. He's been up in Oslo. He's been reporting for us there all day. In fact, all week, actually, on a lot of these other things.
Exactly.
You've got Lars. Who
else? It's a roundup from Norway. And after that, after Lars has given up everything we need to know from Norway's side, we're going to be talking about what the actual consequences of this Nobel Peace Prize are going to be regarding what's going on in Syria, what's going on with chemical weapons, and so on. So therefore, Fawaz Sergez is joining the programme as well, and he's giving us his word and his views on this topic.
Good stuff. And a little bit later?
A little bit later, then, we are talking about what's going on in Reykjavik this weekend. Arctic Circle Conference takes place this weekend, which is quite interesting, actually. One more example of how there is more and more attention being given to what's happening at the Arctic region and how it's gaining more political importance.
Indeed, something that you can read more about in the next issue of Monocle.
Exactly.
On newsstands next week, the Arctic-themed issue. Barbara, the Daily, what do we have to look forward to?
So first of all, Steve, this week we've been looking a lot at the US government shutdown, and tonight we're going to take a step back from the kind of the immediate discussion, and we're going to ask why.
Why
is everything so dysfunctional?
Together, essentially,
yeah, and we're going to particularly focus on the radicalization of, you know, a certain part of the Republican Party. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. We're going to kind of examine this.
What's gone wrong?
A little bit more deeply.
We've also got Asia Culture tonight, haven't we, with Bernie Cho?
That's actually in Marcus's show.
Is that in the Globalist Asia?
You didn't
give me a chance of telling about that as well.
Oh, that's one of my favourite items on a Friday.
I know when
Bernie sort of gives us his take on what's going on.
Steve, are you going to be at Midori House listening to the programme, or are you going to be at home listening to the programme?
I'm actually going out for dinner, but I will make sure I'm going.
You have your phone app with you, so you can listen.
I won't be listening to it live. I will listen to it tomorrow. I'm going to download it and listen to it. I'm going to Bristol for the weekend, so on the train, I'll listen to it then. I'll listen to Bernie. Has he got some good stuff?
He does have amazing stuff, as always.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. So that is Globalist Asia in just under an hour's time. Monocle Daily in just over an hour's time, rather. Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Thank you both. That is all for today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, George Brock from City University and Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmanich and Maddie Araujo. And our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next up, it's more Marcus. Marcus, what are you doing?
I'm hosting the menu.
You've got the menu. Remembered. Good. Okay, I'm glad. He's got a few things there, including Michelin star chef Daniel Patterson, whose San Francisco restaurant Qua is a subject of a new book. Who would have thought? Then, of course, as you know, Globalist Asia, Monocle Daily. It's all on. Yeah, just stick it on. If you're not going to have dinner, stick on Monocle 24. It'll be great, I promise. We're going to be back at the same time on Monday, and next week we've got some very special aperitivos. We'll tell you all about those next week. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.